Sunlight holds up precious nylons one by one to find a pair that hasn't laddered, each struck flashing by the light through the winter trellis outside. Nasal, hep American girl voices singing out of the grooves of some disc up through the thorn needle of Allison's mother's radiogram. Snuggling for warmth, blackout curtains over all the windows, no light but the coal of their last cigarette, an English firefly, bobbing at her whim in cursive writing that trails a bit behind, words he can't read. What happened? Silence from Slothrop. Your two wrens, when they saw you. Then he notices that Slothrop, instead of going on with his story, has given himself up to shivering. Has been shivering, in fact, for some time. It's cold in here, but not that cold. Slothrop?
I don't know. Jesus.
It's interesting, though. It's the weirdest feeling. He can't stop. He turns his Ike jacket collar up, tucks hands inside sleeves, and sits that way for a while. Presently, after a pause, cigarette in motion.
You can't hear them when they come in.
Kent Ivey knows which they. His eyes shift away. There is silence for a bit. Of course you can't. They go faster than sound.
Yes, but that's not it.
Words are bursting up between the pulses of shivering.
The other kind. Those V1s. You can hear them, right? Maybe you have a chance to get out of the way, but these things explode first. And then you hear them coming in. Except that if you're dead, you don't hear them.
Same in the infantry. You know that. You never hear the one that gets you.
But think of it as a very large bullet, Slothrop, with fins. Jesus, teeth chattering. You're such a comfort.
Pant Ivy, leaning anxiously through the smell of hops and the brown gloom, more worried now about Slothrop's shaking than any specter of his own, has nothing but established channels he happens to know of to try and conjure it away. Why not see if we can get you out to where some of them have hit?
What for? Come on, Tenth Ivy, they're completely destroyed, aren't they?
I don't know. I doubt even the Germans know, but it's the best chance we'll have to one-up that lot over in T.I., isn't it? Which is how Slothrop got into investigating V-bomb incidents, aftermaths. Each morning, at first, someone in civil defense routed, Achtung, a list of yesterday's hits. It would come round to Slothrop last. He'd detach its pencil-smeared buck slip, go draw the same aging Humber from the motor pool, and make his rounds. A St. George after the fact, going out to poke about for droppings of the beast, fragments of German hardware that wouldn't exist, writing empty summaries into his notebooks. Work therapy. As inputs to Achtung got faster, often he'd show up in time to help the search crews, following restless, muscled RAF dogs into the plaster smell, the gas leaking, the leaning long splinters and sagging mesh, the prone and noseless caryatids, rust already at nails and naked thread surfaces, the powdery wipe of nothing's hand across wallpaper, a whisper with peacocks spreading their fans down deep lawns to Georgian houses long ago, to safe groves of home oak. Among the calls for silence following to where some exposed hand or brightness of skin waited them, survivor or casualty. When he couldn't help, he stayed clear, praying at first, conventionally to God, first time since the other blitz, for life to win out. But too many were dying, and presently, seeing no point, he stopped. Yesterday happened to be a good day. They found a child. Alive, a little girl half-suffocated under a Morrison shelter. Waiting for the stretcher, Slothrop held her small hand, gone purple with the cold. Dogs barked in the street. When she opened her eyes and saw him, her first words were, "Any gum, chum?" Trapped there for 2 days, gumless, all he had for her was a Thayer's slippery elm. He felt like an idiot. Before they took her off, she brought his hand over to kiss anyway, her mouth and cheek in the flare lamps cold as frost. The city around them at once a big, desolate icebox, stale smelling and no surprises inside ever again. At which point she smiled very faintly, and he knew that's what he'd been waiting for. Wow, a Shirley Temple smile, as if this exactly cancelled all they'd found her down in the middle of. What a damn fool thing. He hangs at the bottom of his blood's avalanche, 300 years of Western Swamp Yankees, and can't manage but some nervous truce with their providence. A detente. Ruins he goes daily to look in are each a sermon on vanity. That he finds, as weeks wear on, no least fragment of any rocket, preaches how indivisible is the act of death. Slothrop's progress. London, the secular city, instructs him, turn any corner, and he can find himself inside a parable. He has become obsessed with the idea of a rocket with his name written on it. If they're really set on getting him, they embracing possibilities far, far beyond Nazi Germany. That's the surest way. Doesn't cost them a thing to paint his name on every one, right? Yes, well, that can be useful. Can't I be watching him funny? Can't it? Especially in combat to, you know, pretend something like that. Jolly useful. Call it operational paranoia or something, but who's pretending? Lighting a cigarette, shaking his forelock through the smoke. Jeepers, Aunt Ivy, listen, I don't want to upset you, but, I mean, I'm 4 years overdue is what it is. It could happen any time, the next second, right? Just suddenly, shit, just zero, just nothing, and it's nothing he can see or lay hands on. Sudden gases, a violence upon the air, and no trace afterward. A word spoken with no warning into your ear, and then silence forever. Beyond its invisibility, beyond hammerfall and doomcrack, here is its real horror, mocking, promising him death with German and precise confidence, laughing down all of Tantivy's quiet decencies. No, no bullet with fins, Ace. Not the word, the one word that rips apart the day. It was Friday evening last September, just off work, heading for the Bond Street underground station. His mind on the weekend ahead and his two wrens, that Norma and that Marjorie, whom he must each keep from learning about the other, just as he was reaching to pick his nose, suddenly in the sky, miles behind his back and up the river, memento mori, a sharp crack and a heavy explosion, rolling right behind, almost like a clap of thunder. But not quite. Seconds later, this time from in front of him, it happened again, loud and clear all over the city, bracketed. Not a buzz bomb. Not that Luftwaffe, not thunder either, he puzzled out loud. Some bloody gas main, a lady with a lunchbox, puffy-eyed from the day, elbowing him in the back as she passed. No, it's the Germans, her friend with rolled blonde fringes under a checked kerchief, doing some monster routine here, raising her hands at Slothrop. Coming to get him. They especially love fat, plump Americans. In a minute she'll be reaching out to pinch his cheek and wobble it back and forth. "Hi, Glamourpuss," Slothrop said. Her name was Cynthia. He managed to get a telephone number before she was waving ta-ta, born again into the rush-hour crowds. It was one of those great iron afternoons in London, the yellow sun being teased apart by a thousand chimneys breathing, fawning upward without shame. This smoke is more than the day's breath, more than dark strength. It is an imperial presence that lives and moves. People were crossing the streets and squares, going everywhere. Buses were grinding off, hundreds of them, down the long concrete viaducts, smeared with years' pitiless use and no pleasure, into haze-gray, grease-black, red-lead and pale aluminum, between scrap heaps that towered high as blocks of flats, down side-shoving curves into roads clogged with army convoys, other tall buses and canvas lorries, bicycles and cars, everyone here with different destinations and beginnings, all flowing, hitching now and then, over it all the enormous gas ruin of the sun among the smokestacks, the barrage balloons, power lines and chimneys brown as aging indoor wood, brown growing deeper, approaching black through an instant, perhaps the true turn of the sunset that is wine to you, wine and comfort. The moment was 6:43:16, British double summer time. The sky beaten like death's drum, still humming, and Slothrop's cock, say what? Yes, look at inside his GI undershorts. Here's a sneaky hard-on stirring, ready to jump. Well, great God, where'd that come from? There is in his history, and likely, God help him, in his dossier, a peculiar sensitivity to what is revealed in the sky. But a hard-on? On the old schist of a tombstone in the Congregational churchyard back home in Minsboro, Massachusetts, the hand of God emerges from a cloud, the edges of the figure here and there eroded by 200 years of seasons, fire, and ice chisels at work, and the inscription reading, in memory of Constant Slothrop, who died March the 4th, 1766, in the 29th year of his age. Death is a debt to nature due, which I have paid, and so must you. Constant saw, and not only with his heart, that stone hand pointing out of the secular clouds, pointing directly at him, its edges traced in unbearable light above the whispering of his river and slopes of his long blue Berkshires, as would his son Variable Slothrop, indeed all of the Slothrop blood one way or another, the 9 or 10 generations tumbling back, branching inward, every one except for William, the very first, lying under fallen leaves, mint and purple loosestrife, chilly elm and willow shadows over the swamp-edge graveyard in a long gradient of rot, leaching, assimilation with the earth, the stones showing round-faced angels with the long noses of dogs, toothy and deep-socketed death's heads, Masonic emblems, flowery urns, feathery willows upright and broken, exhausted hourglasses, sun faces about to rise or set with eyes peeking Kilroy style over the horizon, and memorial verse, running from straight on and four square as for Constant Slothrop, through bouncy star-spangled banner meter for Mrs. Elizabeth, wife of Lieutenant Isaiah Slothrop, died 1812. Adieu, my dear friends, I have come to this grave, where insatiate death in his reaping hath brought me. Till Christ rise again, all his children to save, I must lie as his word in the scriptures hath taught me. Mark, reader, my cry, bend thy thoughts on the sky, and in midst of prosperity know thou mayest die, while the great loom of God works in darkness above, and our trials here below are but threads of his love. To the current Slothrop's grandfather, Frederick, died 1933, who in typical sarcasm and guile bagged his epitaph from Emily Dickinson without a credit line. Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. Each one, in turn, paying his debt to nature due, and leaving the excess to the next link in the name's chain. They began as fur traders, cordwainers, salters, and smokers of bacon, went on into glassmaking, became selectmen, builders of tanneries, quarriers of marble. Country for miles around gone to necropolis, gray with marble dust, dust that was the breaths, the ghosts of all those fake Athenian monuments going up elsewhere across the Republic. Always elsewhere. The money seeping its way out through stock portfolios more intricate than any genealogy. What stayed at home in Berkshire went into timberland, whose diminishing green reaches were converted acres at a clip into paper, toilet paper, banknote stock, newsprint. A medium or ground for shit, money, and the word. They were not aristocrats. No Slothrop ever made it into the social register or the Somerset Club. They carried on their enterprise in silence, assimilated in life to the dynamic that surrounded them thoroughly as in death they would be to churchyard earth. Shit, money, and the word. The three American truths, powering the American mobility, claimed the Slothrops, clasped them for good to the country's fate. But they did not prosper. About all they did was persist. Though it all began to go sour for them around the time Emily Dickinson, never far away, was writing, "Ruin is formal devil's work, consecutive and slow. Fail in an instant, no man did. Slipping is crash's law." Still, they would keep on. The tradition for others was clear, everyone knew. Mine it out, work it, take all you can till it's gone, then move on west. There's plenty more. But out of some reasoned inertia, the Slothrops stayed east in Berkshire, perverse, close to the flooded quarries and logged-off hillsides they'd left like signed confessions across all that thatchy brown, moldering witch country. The profits slackening, the family ever multiplying. Interest from various numbered trusts was still turned by family banks down in Boston every second or third generation back into yet another trust in long rallentando, in infinite series, just perceptibly, term by term, dying, but never quite to the zero. The Depression, by the time it came, ratified what had been underway. Slothrop grew up in a hilltop desolation of businesses going under. Hedges around the estates of the vastly rich, half-mythical cottagers from New York, lapsing back now to green wilderness or straw death, all the crystal windows, every single one smashed, Harriman's and Whitney's gone, lawns growing to hay, and the autumn's no longer a time for foxtrots in the distances, limousines and lamps, but only the accustomed crickets again, apples again, early frosts to send the hummingbirds away, east wind, October rain, only winter certainties. In 1931, the year of the great Aspinwall Hotel fire, young Tyrone was visiting his aunt and uncle in Lenox. It was in April, but for a second or two as he was coming awake in the strange room and the racket of big and little cousins' feet down the stairs, he thought of winter, because so often he'd been wakened like this, at this hour of sleep, by Pop or Hogan, bundled outside, still blinking through an overlay of dream into the cold, to watch the northern lights. They scared the shit out of him. Were the radiant curtains just about to swing open? What would the ghosts of the north in their finery have to show him? But this was a spring night, and the sky was gusting red, warm orange. The sirens howling in the valleys from Pittsfield, Lenox, and Lee, neighbors stood out on their porches to stare up at the shower of sparks falling down on the mountainside. Like a meteor shower, they said, like cinders from the 4th of July. It was 1931, and those were the comparisons. The embers fell on and on for 5 hours, while kids dozed and grown-ups got to drink coffee and tell fire stories from other years. But what lights were these? What ghosts in command? And suppose, in the next moment, all of it, the complete night, were to go out of control and curtains part to show us a winter no one has guessed at? 6:43:16 BDST. In the sky right now, here is the same unfolding, just about to break through, his face deepening with its light, everything about to rush away and he to lose himself just as his countryside has ever proclaimed. Slender church steeples poised up and down, all these autumn hillsides, white rockets about to fire, only seconds of countdown away, rose windows taking in Sunday light, elevating and washing the faces above the pulpit's defining grace, swearing this is how it does happen, yes, the great bright hand reaching out of the cloud. On the wall, in an ornate fixture of darkening bronze, a gas jet burns, laminar and gently singing, adjusted to what scientists of the last century called a sensitive flame. Invisible at the base as it issues from its orifice, fading upward into smooth blue light that hovers several inches above, a glimmering small cone that can respond to the most delicate changes in the room's air pressure. It registers visitors as they enter and leave, each curious and civil as if the round table held some game of chance. The circle of sitters is not at all distracted or hindered, none of your white hands or luminous trumpets here. Cameron's officers in parade trews, blue puttees, dress kilts drift in, conversing with enlisted Americans. There are clergymen, home guard or fire service just off duty, folds of wool clothing heavy with smoke smell, everyone grudging an hour's sleep and looking it. Ancient Edwardian ladies in crepe de chine, West Indians softly plaiting vowels round less flexible chains of Russian Jewish consonants. Most skate tangent to the holy circle. Some stay, some are off again to other rooms, all without breaking in on the slender medium who sits nearest the sensitive flame with his back to the wall, reddish-brown curls tightening close as a skullcap, high forehead unwrinkled, dark lips moving, now effortless, now in pain. Once transected into the realm of Dominus Blissero, Roland found that all the signs had turned against him. Lights he had studied so well as one of you, position and movement, now gathered there at the opposite end, all in dance, irrelevant dance. None of Blissero's traditional progress, no something new, alien. Roland, too, became conscious of the wind, as his mortality had never allowed him, discovered it so, so joyful that the arrow must veer into it. The wind had been blowing all year long, year after year. but Roland had felt only the secular wind. He means only his personal wind. Yet, Selina, the wind's everywhere. Here the medium breaks off, is silent a while. One groan, a quiet, desperate moment. Selina, Selina, have you gone then? No, my dear, her cheeks mottled with previous tears. I'm listening. It's control. All these things arise from one difficulty, control. For the first time it was inside, do you see? The control is put inside. No more need to suffer passively under outside forces, to veer into any wind, as if a market needed no longer be run by the invisible hand, but now could create itself, its own logic, momentum, style, from inside. Putting the control inside was ratifying what de facto had happened, that you had dispensed with God. But you had taken on a greater and more harmful illusion, the illusion of control, that A could do B. But that was false, completely. No one can do. Things only happen. A and B are unreal, are names for parts that ought to be inseparable. More Uspenskaya nonsense, whispers a lady brushing by on the arm of a dock worker. Odors of diesel fuel and soulevant mingle as they pass. Jessica Swanlake, a young, rosy girl in the uniform of an ATS private, noticing the pre-war perfume, looks up. The frock, she imagines, is about 15 guineas, and who knows how many coupons, probably from Harrods, and would do more for me, she's also sure. The lady, suddenly looking back over her shoulder, smiles. Oh, yes? My gosh, did she hear? Around this place, almost certainly. Jessica's been standing near the séance table with a handful of darts idly plucked from the board on the wall, her head bent, pale nape and top vertebra visible above the brown wool collar, and through some of her lighter brown hair fallen either side along her cheeks. Brass throats and breasts warm to her blood quake in the hollow of her hand. She seems herself, gentling their feathered crosses, brushing with fingertips, to have slid into a shallow trance. Outside, rolling from the east, comes the muffled rip of another rocket bomb. The windows rattle, the floor shakes. The sensitive flame dives for shelter, shadows across the table scent a dance, darkening toward the other room. Then it leaps high, the shadows drawing inward again, fully 2 feet, and disappears completely. Gas hisses on in the dim room. Milton Gloaming, who achieved perfect tripos at Cambridge 10 years ago, abandons his shorthand to rise and go shut the gas off. It seems the right moment now for Jessica to throw a dart. One dart. Hair swinging, breasts bobbing marvelously beneath each heavy wool lapel. A hiss of air, whack, into the sticky fibers, into the dead center. Milton Gloaming cocks an eyebrow. His mind, always gathering correspondences, thinks it has found a new one. The medium, irritable now, has begun to drift back out of his trance. Anybody's guess what's happening over on the other side. This sitting, like any, needs not only its congenial circle here and secular, but also a basic four-way entente which oughtn't any link of it to be broken. Roland Feldspath, the spirit. Peter Saxa, the control. Carol Eventer, the medium. Selina, the wife and survivor. Somewhere, through exhaustion, redirection, gusts of white noise out in the ether, this arrangement has begun now to dissolve. Relaxation, chairs squeaking, sighs and throat clearings. Milton Gloaming fusses with his notebook, shuts it abruptly. Presently Jessica comes wandering over, no sign of Roger, and she's not sure he wants her to come looking for him. And Gloaming, though shy, isn't as horrid as some of Roger's other friends. Roger says that now you'll count up all those words you copied and graph them or something, brightly, to head off any comment on the dart incident, which she'd rather avoid. Do you do it only for seances? Automatic texts. Girl nervous, Gloaming, frowns, nods. One or two Ouija board episodes, yes, yes. We're trying to develop a vocabulary of curves, certain pathologies, certain characteristic shapes, you see. I'm not sure that I... Well, recall Zipf's principle of least effort. If we plot the frequency of a word P sub N against its rank order N on logarithmic axes, babbling into her silence, even her bewilderment graceful, we should, of course, get something like a straight line. However,
We've data that suggest the curves for certain conditions. Well, they're actually quite different. Schizophrenics, for example, tend to run a bit flatter in the upper part, then progressively steeper, a sort of bow shape. I think with this chap, this Roland, that we're onto a classical paranoiac. Ah, that's a word she knows. Thought I saw you brighten up there when he said turned against. Against, opposite, yes, you'd be amazed at the frequency with this one. What's the most frequent word, asks Jessica. You're number one. The same as it's always been at these affairs, replies the statistician as if everyone knew. Death. An elderly air raid warden, starchy and frail as organdy, stands on tiptoe to relight the sensitive flame. Incidentally, where's your mad young gentleman gone off to? Rogers with Captain Prentice, waving vaguely. The usual mysterious microfilm drill. Being transacted in some distant room across a crown-and-anchor game with which chance has very little to do, billows of smoke and chatter, Falkman and his Apache band subdued over the BBC, chunky pints and slender sherry glasses, winter rain at the windows. Time for closeting, gas logs, shawls against the cold night, snug with your young lady or old Dutch or, as here at Snoxall's, in good company. Here's a shelter, perhaps a real node of tranquility among several scattered throughout this long wartime, where they're gathering for purposes not entirely in the martial interest. Pirate Prentice feels something of this, obliquely, by way of class nervousness, really. He bears his grin among these people here like a phalanx. He learned it at the films. It is the exact mischievous Irish grin your Dennis Morgan chap goes about cocking down at the black smoke vomiting from each and every little bucktooth yellow rat he shoots down. It's as useful to him as he is to the firm, who, it is well known, will use anyone, traitors, murderers, perverts, negroes, even women, to get what they want. They may not have been that sure of pirates' usefulness at first, but later, as it developed, they were to grow very sure indeed. Major General, you can't actually give your support to this. We're watching him around the clock. He certainly isn't leaving the premises physically. Then he has a confederate. Somehow, hypnosis, drugs, I don't know, they're getting to his man and tranquilizing him. For God's sake, next you'll be consulting horoscopes. Hitler does. Hitler is an inspired man, but you and I are employees, remember? After that first surge of interest, the number of clients assigned to Pirate tapered off some. At the moment, he carries what he feels is a comfortable caseload. But it's not what he really wants. End of side one. To continue, turn the cassette over.
Side two. Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon. Continuing on page 37. They will not understand the gently bricks of S.O.E. Ah, good, Captain. Rattling citrips, shuffling boots, echoes off of government eyeglasses. Jolly good, and why not do it actually for us sometime at the club? Pirate wants their trust, the good whiskey and cured Latakia scent of their rough love. He wants understanding from his own lot, not these bookish sods and rationalized freaks here at Snoxall's, so dedicated to science, so awfully tolerant that this, he regrets it with all his heart, may be the only place in the reach of war's empire that he does feel less than a stranger. It's not at all clear, Roger Mexo has been saying, what they have in mind, not at all. The witchcraft acts more than 200 years old. It's a relic of a different age, another way of thinking. Suddenly, here we are, 1944, being hit with convictions right and left. Our Mr. Evans here, motioning medium, who's across the room chatting with young Gavin, could be fallen upon at any moment, pouring in the windows, hauling dangerous, tough Eventyr away to the scrubs on pretending to etize or use a kind of conjuration to cause the spirits of deceased persons to be present, in fact, at the place where he then was. Those spirits were communicating with living persons then and there present. My God, what imbecile fascist rot. Careful, Mexico, you're losing the old objectivity again. A man of science shouldn't want to do that, should he? Hardly scientific, is it? Ass. You're on their side. Couldn't you feel it tonight coming in the door? It's a great swamp of paranoia. That's my talent, all right. Pirate, as he speaks, knowing it's too abrupt, tries to file off the flood with, I don't know that I'm up to the multiple sort of thing. Ah, Prentice. Not an eyebrow or lip out of place. tolerance. Ah. You ought to come down this time and have our Dr. Ghost check it out on his EEG. Oh, if I'm in town, vaguely. There's a security problem here. Loose talk sinks ships, and he can't be sure even about Mexico. There are too many circles to the current operation, inner and outer. Distribution lists growing narrower as we move ring by ring toward the bullseye. In some way, grand compassing every scrap, little memo, typewriter ribbon. His best guess is that Mexico only now and then supports the firm's latest mania, known as Operation Black Wing, in a statistical way, analyzing what foreign morale data may come in, for instance, someplace out at the fringes of the enterprise, as indeed Pirate finds himself here tonight, acting as go-between for Mexico and his own roommate, Teddy Bloat. He knows that Bloat goes somewhere and microfilms something, then transfers it via Pirate to Young Mexico, down to the Visitation, which houses a catch-all agency known as Pisces. Psychological intelligence schemes for expediting whose surrender is not made clear. Pirate wonders if Mexico isn't into yet another of the 1,000 intra-allied surveillance schemes that have sprung up about London since the Americans and a dozen governments in exile moved in which the German curiously fades into irrelevance. Everyone watching over his shoulder, free French plotting revenge on Vichy traitors, Lublin communists drawing beads on Varsovian shadow ministers, Greeks stalking royalists, unrepatriable dreamers of all languages being through will, fists, prayer to bring back kings, republics, pretenders, summer anarchisms that perished before the first crops were in. Some died nameless under ice and snow surfaces of bomb craters out in the East End, not to be found till spring. Some chronically drunk or opiated for getting through the day's reverses. Most somehow losing. Losing what souls they had. Less and less able to trust. Seized in the game's unending chatter, its daily self-criticism, its demands for total attention. And what foreigner is exactly that Pi has in mind, if it isn't that stateskar across his own mirror, poorest of exiles? Well, he guesses they have euchred Mexico into some such Byzantine exercise, probably to do with the Americans. Perhaps the Russian, the white Visitation, being devoted to psychological warfare, harbors a few of each. A behavior, a Pavlovian there. It's none of Pirate's miss, but he notes that with each film delivery, Roger's enthusiasm grows. Unhealthy. Unhealthy. He has the sense of witnessing an addiction. He feels that his provisional wartime friend is being used for not quite decent. What can he do? If Mexico talk about it, he could find a way, security or not. His reluctance is not Pirate's own over the machinery of Operation Blackwing. It looks more like shame. Wasn't Mexico's face tonight, as he took the envelope, averted, eyes boxing the corners of the room at top speed? A pornography customer's reflex. Knowing Bloat, perhaps that's what it is, young lady gamming, well-set-up young man, several poses, more wholesome than anything this war's ever photographed. Life, at least. There's Mexico's girl just entering the room. He spots her immediately, the clarity around her, the absence of smoke and noise. Auras now? She catches sight of Roger and smiles, her eyes enormous, dark-lashed, no makeup or none Pirate can see, her hair worn in a roll down to the shoulders. What the hell's she doing in a mixed AA battery? She ought to be in a naffy canteen, filling coffee cups. He is suddenly, dodderer and ass, taken by an ache in his skin, a simple love for them both that asks nothing but their safety, and that he'll always manage to describe as something else, concern, you know, fondness. In 1936, Pirate, the T.S. Eliot April, she called it, though it was a colder time of year, was in love with an executive's wife. She was a thin, speedy stalk of a girl named Scorpia Mossmoon. Her husband, Clive, was an expert in plastics, working out of Cambridge for Imperial Chemicals. Pirate, the career soldier, was having a year or two's relapse or fling outside in civilian life. He'd got the feeling, stationed east of Suez, places like Bahrain, drinking beer watered with his own falling soil stink of crude oil across from Muharraq. Restricted to quarters after sundown. 98% venereal rate anyway. One sunburned, scroungy unit of force, preserving the sheikh and the oil money against any threat from east of the English Channel. Horny, mad with the itching of lice and heat rash. Masturbating under these conditions is exquisite torture. Bitter drunk all the time. Even so, there had leaked through to Pirate a dim suspicion that life was passing him by. Incredible black-and-white Scorpia confirmed not a few piratical fantasies about the glamorous, silken-carved English real world he'd felt so shut away from. They got together while Clive was away on a troubleshooting mission for ICI in, of all places, Bahrain. The symmetry of this helped Pirate relax about it some. They would attend parties as strangers, though she never learned to arm herself against unexpected sight of him across a room, trying to belong, as if he were not someone's employee. She found him touching in his ignorance of everything. Partying, love, money. Felt world and desperately caring for this moment of boyhood among his ways imperialized and set. He was 33. His pre-austerity, in which Scorpia figured as his last fling, though herself too young to know that, to know, like Pirate, what the lyrics to Dancing in the Dark are really about. He was jealous about never telling her, but there are times when it's agony not to go to her feet, knowing she won't leave Clive, crying, "You're my last chance. If it can, there's no more time." Doesn't he wish, against all hope, that he could let the poor Western man's timetable go? But how does a man, where does he even begin at age 33? "But that's just it." She'd have laughed, not so much annoyed, she would have laughed, as tickled by the unreality of the problem, herself too lost at the manic edge of him, always at engage, so taking, cleaving her for more than when jerking off into an army flannel in the Persian Gulf was some collar of love's nettles, now at him, at his cock, too unappeasable for her not to give in to the insanity of, but too insane, really, even to think of Clive. Convenient as hell for her, anyway. Roger Mexico is now going through much the same thing with Jessica, in this case being known as Beaver. Pirate has looked on but never talked about it to Mexico. Yes, he is waiting to see if it will end for Roger the same way. Part of him, never so cheery as at the spectacle of another's misfortune, rooting for Beaver and all that he, like Clive, stands for to win out. But another part, an alternate self, one that he mustn't be quick to call decent, does seem to want for Roger what Pirate himself lost. "You are a pirate," she'd whispered the last day. Neither of them knew it was the last day. "You've come and taken me off on your pirate ship, a girl of good family and the usual repressions. You've raped me, and I'm the red bitch of the high seas." A lovely game. Pirated up sooner. Already the last way down afternoon, hours of fuck love with it to uncouple, how the borrowed room rocked gently, the ceiling down a foot, lamps from their fittings, some fraction of the Thameside traffic provided salty cries over the water and nautical bells. But back over their lowering sky sea behind, government hounds were on the track, drawing closer. The cutters are coming, the cutters and the sleek hermaphrodites of the law, agents who, being old hands, will settle for her safe return, won't insist on his execution or capture. Their logic is sound. Give him a bad enough wound, and he'll come round, round to the ways of this hard-boiled old egg of world and timetables, cycling night to compromise night. He left her at Waterloo Station. A gala crowd was there to see Fred Roper's company of wonder midgets off to an imperial fair in Johannesburg, South Africa. Midgets in their dark winter clothes, exquisite little frocks and nip-waisted overcoats, were running all over the station, gobbling their bon voyage chocolates and lining up for news photos. Scorpia's talc-white face through the last window across the last gate was a blow to his heart. A flurry of giggles and best wishes arose from the Wonder Midgets and their admirers. Well, thought Pirate, guess I'll go back in the army. They're bound eastward now, Roger peering over the wheel, hunched Dracula-style inside his Burberry, Jessica with bright millions of droplets still clinging in soft net to her shoulders and sleeves of drab wool. They want to be together, in bed, at rest, in love. And instead it's eastward tonight and south of the Thames to rendezvous with a certain high questionist before the clock of St. Felix chimes one. And when the mice run down, who knows tonight but what they've run for good. Her face against the breath-fogged window has become another dimness, another light trick of the winter. Beyond her, the white fracture of the rain passes. Why does he go out and pinch all his dogs in person? He's an administrator, isn't he? Wouldn't he hire a boy or something? We call them staff, Roger replies. And I don't know why Pointsman does anything he does. He's a Pavlovian, love. He's a royal fellow. What am I supposed to know about any of those people? They're as difficult as the lock back in Snuxall's. They're both of them peevish tonight, whippy as sheets of glass improperly annealed, ready to go smash at any indefinite touch in a whining matrix of stresses. Poor Roger, poor lamb, he's having an awful war. All right, his head shaking, a fuming bee or pea that refuses to explode. Ah, you're so clever, aren't you? Raving Roger, hands off the wheel to help the words out. Windscreen wipers clicking right along. You've been able to shoot back now and then at the odd flying buzz bomb, you and the boyfriend, dear old Nutria. Beaver. Quite right. And all that magnificent esprit you lot are so justly famous for, but you haven't brought down many rockets lately, have you? Ha ha! Gurning his most spiteful, pursed smile up against wrinkled nose and eyes. Any more than I. Any more than Pointsman. Well, who's that make purer than whom these days, eh, my love? Bouncing up and down in a leather seat. By now, her hands reaching out, about to touch his shoulder. She rests her cheek on her own arm, hair spilling, drowsy, watching him. Can't get a decent argument going with her. How he's tried. She uses her silences like stoking hands to divert him and hush their corners of rooms, bed covers, tabletops, accidental spaces. Even at the cinema, watching that awful Going My Way, the day they met, he saw every white straying of her ungauntleted hands, could feel in his skin each saccade of her olive, her amber, her coffee-colored eyes. He's wasted gallons of paint thinner, striking his faithful Zippo, its charred wick, virility giving way to thrift, rationed down to a little stub, the blue flames sparking about the edges in the dark, the many kinds of dark, just to see what's happening with her face. Each new flame, a new face. And there have been the moments, more of them lately too, times when face to face there has been no way to tell which of them is which, both at the same time feeling the same eerie confusion. Something like looking in a mirror by surprise, but more than that, the feeling of actually being joined, when after, who knows, 2 minutes, a week, they realize, separate again, what's been going on, that Roger and Jessica were merged into a joint creature unaware of itself. In a life he has cursed again and again, for its need to believe so much in the trans-observable, here is the first, the very first real magic. Data he can't argue away. It was what Hollywood likes to call a cute meet, out in the neat 18th century heart of downtown Tunbridge Wells. Roger motoring in the vintage Jaguar up to London, Jessica at the roadside struggling prettily with a busted bicycle, murky wool ATS skirt hiked up on a handlebar, most non-regulation black slip and clear pearl thighs above the khaki stockings. Well, here, love, breaks on in a high squeak. It's not backstage at the old windmill or something, you know. She knew. A curl dropping down to tickle her nose and put a bit more than the usual acid in her reply. Are they letting little boys into places like that? I didn't know. Well, nobody's, having learned by now to live with remarks about his appearance, called up the girl guide yet either, have they?
I'm 20.
Hurrah, that qualifies you for a ride in this Jaguar here, you see, all the way to London. But I'm going the other way, nearly to Battle. Oh, round trip, of course. Shaking hair back out of her face. Does your mother know you're out like this? My mother is the war, declares Roger Mexico, leaning over to open the door. That's a queer thing to say. One muddy little shoe, pondering on the running board. Come along, love. You're holding up the mission. Leave the machine where it is. Mind your skirt getting in. I wouldn't want to commit an unspeakable act out here in the streets of Tunbridge Wells. At which moment, the rocket falls. Cute. Cute. A thud, a hollow drum roll. Far enough toward the city to be safe, but close and loud enough to send her the 100 miles between herself and the stranger. Long, swooping, balletic, her marvelous round bottom turning to settle in the other seat. Hair in a moment's fan, hand sweeping army-colored skirt under, graceful as a wing, all with the blast still reverberating. He thinks he can see a solemn, gnarled something, deeper or changing faster than clouds, rising to the north. Will she snuggle now cutely against him, ask him to protect her? He didn't even believe she'd get in the car, rocket or no rocket. Accordingly, now puts Pointsman's Jaguar somehow into reverse instead of low. Yes, backs over the bicycle, rendering it in a great crunch useless for anything but scrap. I'm in your power, she cries. Utterly. Roger at length, finding his gear, dancing among the pedals, snarl off to London. But Jessica's not in his power. And the war, well, she is Roger's mother. She's leached at all the soft, the vulnerable inclusions of hope and praise, scattered beneath the mica dazzle, through Roger's mineral grave marker self, washed it all moaning away on her gray tide. 6 years now, always just in sight, just where he can see her. He's forgotten his first corpse, or when he first saw someone living die. That's how long it's been going on. Most of his life, it seems. The city he visits nowadays is death's antechamber, where all the paperwork's done, the contracts signed, the days numbered. Nothing of the grand, garden, adventurous capital his childhood knew. He's become the dour young man of the white visitation. The spider, hitching together his web of numbers. It's an open secret that he doesn't get on with the rest of his section. How can he? They're all wild talents, clairvoyants and mad magicians, telekinetics, astral travelers, gatherers of light. Roger's only a statistician. Never had a prophetic dream. Never sent or got a telepathic message, never touched the other world directly. If anything's there, it will show in the experimental data, won't it, in the numbers. But that's as close or clear as he'll ever get. Any wonder he's a bit short with Psi section, all the definitely 3 sigma lot up and down his basement corridor. Jesus Christ, wouldn't you be? That one clear need of theirs, so patent, exasperates him. His need, too, all right. But how are you ever going to put anything psychical on a scientific basis with your mortality always goading, just outside the chi-square calculations, in between the flips of the Zener cards and the silences among the medium's thick, straining utterances? In his mellower moments, he thinks that continuing to try makes him brave. But most of the time he's cursing himself for not working in fire control or graphing standardized kill rates per ton for the bomber groups. Anything but this thankless meddling into the affairs of invulnerable death. They have drawn near a glow over the rooftops. Fire service vehicles come roaring by them, heading the same direction. It is an oppressive region of brick streets and silent walls. Roger breaks for a crowd of sappers, firefighters, neighbors in dark coats over white night clothes, old ladies who have a special place in their night thoughts for the fire service. No, please, you're not going to use that great hose on me. Oh, no, aren't you even going to take off those horrid rubber boots? Yes, yes, that's... Soldiers stand every few yards, a loose cordon, unmoving, a bit supernatural. The Battle of Britain was hardly so formal, but these new robot bombs bring with them chances for public terror no one has sounded. Jessica notes a coal-black Packard up a side street filled with dark-suited civilians, their white collars rigid in the shadows. Who are they? He shrugs. They is good enough. Not a friendly lot.
Look who's talking.
But their smile is old, habitual. There was a time when his job had her a bit mental. Lovely little scrapbooks on the flying bombs. How sweet. And his irritated sigh. Jess, don't make me out some cold, fanatical man of science. Heat beats at their faces. Eyes searing yellow when the streams shoot into the fire. A ladder hooked to the edge of the roof sways in the violent drafts. Up top against the sky, figures in slickers brace, wave arms, move together to pass orders. Half a block down, flare lamps illuminate the rescue work in the charry, wet wreckage. From trailer pumps and heavy units, canvas hoses run fat with pressure, hastily threaded unions sending out stars of cold spray, bitter cold that flash yellow when the fire leaps. Somewhere over a radio comes a woman's voice, a quiet Yorkshire girl dispatching other units to other parts of the city. Once Roger and Jessica might have stopped, but they're both alumni of the Battle of Britain. Both have been drafted into the early black mornings and the crying for mercy, the dumb inertia of cobbles and beams, the profound shortage of mercy in those days. By the time one has pulled one's nth victim or part of a victim free of one's nth pile of rubble, he told her once, angry, weary, it has ceased to be that personal. The value of N may be different for each of us, but I'm sorry. Sooner or later. And past the exhaustion with it, there is also this. If they have not quite seceded from war's state, at least they found the beginnings of gentle withdrawal. There's never been the space or time to talk about it, and perhaps no need. But both know, clearly, it's better together, snuggled in, than back out in the paper, fires, khaki, steel of the home front. That, indeed, the home front is something of a fiction and lie designed, not too subtly, to draw them apart, to subvert love in favor of work, abstraction, required pain, bitter death. They have found a house in the stay-away zone, under the barrage balloons south of London. The town, evacuated in 40, is still regulated, still on the ministry's list. Roger and Jessica occupy the place illegally. In a defiance they can never measure unless they're caught. Jessica has brought an old doll, seashells, her aunt's grip filled with lace knickers and silk stockings. Roger's managed to scare off a few chickens to nest in the empty garage. Whenever they meet here, one always remembers to bring a fresh flower or two. The nights are filled with explosion and motor transport, and wind that brings them up over the downs a last smack of the sea. Day begins with a hot cup and a cigarette over a little table with a weak leg that Roger has repaired, provisionally, with brown twine. There's never much talk but touches and looks, smiles together, curses for parting. It is marginal, hungry, chilly. Most times they're too paranoid to risk a fire. But it's something they want to keep. So much that to keep it, they will take on more than propaganda has ever asked them for. They are in love. Fuck the war. Tonight's quarry, whose name will be Vladimir, or Ilya, Sergei, Nikolai, depending on the doctor's whim, slinks carefully toward the cellar entrance. This jagged opening ought to lead to something deep and safe. He has the memory or reflex of escaping into similar darkness from an Irish setter who smells of coal smoke and will attack on sight. Once from a pack of children, recently from a sudden blast of noise light, a fall of masonry that caught him on the left hindquarter, still raw, still needs licking. But tonight's threat is something new. Not so violent, instead a systematic stealth he isn't used to. Life out here is more direct. It's raining, the wind hardly flickers. It brings a scent he finds strange, never having been near a laboratory in his life. The smell is ether. It emanates from Mr. Edward W. A. Pointsman, FRCS. As the dog vanishes around the broken remnant of a wall, just as the tip of his tail flicks away, the doctor steps into the white, waiting throat of a toilet bowl he has not, so intent on his prey, seen. He bends over, awkwardly, tugging loose the bowl from its surrounding debris, muttering oaths against all the careless, meaning not himself particularly, but the owners of this ruined flat, if they weren't killed in the blast, or whoever failed to salvage this bowl, which seems actually to be wedged on rather tight. Mr. Pointsman drags his leg over to a shattered staircase, swings it quietly, so as not to alarm the dog, against the lower half of a fumed oak newel post. The bowl only clanks back the wood shutters. Mocking him, all right. He sits on stair steps ascending to open sky and attempts to pull the damned thing loose of his foot. It will not come. He hears the invisible dog, toenails softly clicking, gain the sanctuary of the cellar. He can't reach inside the toilet bowl even to untie his fucking boot. Settling the window of his balaclava helmet snug and tickling just under his nose, resolved not to give way to panic, Mr. Pointsman stands up, has to wait for blood to drain, resurge, bounce up and down its million branches in the drizzly night, percolate to balance, then, limping, clanking, he heads back toward the car to get a hand from young Mexico, who did remember, he hopes, to bring the electric lantern. Roger and Jessica found him a bit earlier, lurking at the end of a street of row houses. The V-bomb, whose mutilation he was prowling, took down four dwellings the other day. Four, exactly, neat as surgery. There is the soft smell of housewood down before its time, of ashes matted down by the rain. Ropes are strung, a sentry lounges silent against the doorway of an intact house next to where the rubble begins. If he and the doctor have chatted at all, neither gives a sign now. Jessica sees two eyes of no particular color glaring out the window of a balaclava helmet and is reminded of a medieval knight wearing a casque. What creature is he possibly here tonight to fight for his king? The rubble waits him, sloping up to broken rear walls in a clogging, an open work of laths pointlessly chevroning, flooring, furniture, glass, chunks of plaster, long tatters of wallpaper, split and shattered joists, some woman's long-gathered nest taken back to separate straws, flung again to this wind and this darkness, back in the wreckage of brass bedpost winks, and twined there someone's brassiere, a white pre-war confection of lace and satin simply left tangled. For an instant, in the vertigo she can't control, all the pity laid up in her heart flies to it, as it would to a small animal stranded and forgotten. Roger has the boot of the car open. The two men are rummaging, coming up with large canvas sack, flask of ether, net, dog whistle. She knows she must not cry, that the vague eyes in the knitted window won't seek their beast any more earnestly for her tears. But the poor, lost, flimsy thing, waiting in the night and rain for its owner, for its room to reassemble round it. The night, full of fine rain, smells like a wet dog. Pointsman seems to have been away for a bit. I've lost my mind. I ought to be cuddling someplace with Beaver this very minute, watching him light up his pipe, and here instead I'm with this gilly or something, this spiritualist, statistician. What are you, anyway? Cuddling? Roger has a tendency to scream. Cuddling? Mexico. It's the doctor sighing, toilet bowl on his foot, and knitted helmet askew. Hello, doesn't that make it difficult for you to walk? Should think it would. Up here, first get it in the door, this way, and ah, good. Then closing the door again around Pointsman's ankle, the bowl now occupying Roger's seat, Roger half resting on Jessica's lap. Tug now, hard as ever you can. Thinking young prig and mocking ass, the doctor rocks back on his free leg, grunting, the bowl wallowing to and fro. Roger holds the door and peers attentively into where the foot vanished. If we had a bit of Vaseline, we could... Something slippery. Wait. Stay there, Pointsman. Don't move. We'll have this resolved. Under the car, impulsive lad, in search of the crankcase plug by the time Pointsman can say, there isn't time, Mexico. He'll escape. He'll escape. Quite right. Up again, fumbling a flashlight from his jacket pocket. I'll flush him out. You wait with the net. So you can get about all right? Nasty if you fell or something just as he made his break for the open. For pity's sake, pointsman thumping after him back into the wreckage. Don't frighten him, Mexico. This isn't Kenya or something. We need him as close to normative, you know, as possible. Normative? Normative? Roger, calls Roger, giving him short, long, short with the flash. Jessica, murmurs Jessica, tiptoeing behind him. Here, fellow, coaxes Roger. Nice bottle of ether here for you. Opening the flask, waving it in the cellar entrance, then switching on his beam. Dog looks up out of an old rusted pram, bobbing black shadows, tongue hanging, utter skepticism on his